Have a listen to this. Do you recognise this famous comedian?
Oh, you're doing essays today. Well, there's a welcome break for it. Like, just so you know, by the way, from the rest of us here who've been through the whole school system with that and have gone to on the other side of the education and all the exams and all that, the stuff you're learning day to day, all the subjects and all the quotes and all of that stuff, like whatever, that stuff, when you get out into the real world and you're looking for work and you're meeting people, that stuff is vital. Frankly, hardly a day goes by that I don't have to quote a theorem or mention a poem. I was in a nightclub the other night and a woman came up and said, what's the biggest of the Great Lakes? And I went, is it Lake Michigan? And she said, close enough, I will go to bed with you.
Dara O'Brien, star of stand-up and shows like Muck the Week and The Apprentice spin-off show You're Fired. He was here last week in Belfast on a five-night run of shows at the waterfront. I've been speaking with him, began by asking him if he liked Belfast.
I do. I'm very fond of Belfast, yeah. I've always had a very good time here. Like, for a room with the best room in the world, which is not made for comedy, because you can see everyone, which is never a good thing. And you can see your own jokes bouncing off the hard walls, you know? You want some intimate and, you know, at least with a flock wallpaper or, you know, heavy curtains. But the waterfront is made for an orchestra. So, you know, but nonetheless, despite this, in spite of that, it's always end up being a kind of an intimate gig.
I don't know how it doesn't absolutely terrify you guys.
There is a comedy. If you think about it for a second, if you consider it just the weight of what you're actually saying here, that I shall make you laugh.
Exactly.
I shall create an involuntary response in you, from a distance, by just saying things, you know, you don't even think about, and then you start thinking about how much, effort people put into buying tickets and booking babysitters and arranging a night, you know. Or the one that really kills you is people who have been dragged along by somebody else go, no, this guy's very good, you'll enjoy this. So now not only have to create an involuntary response in you, I have to tickle your friend from a distance. That's the one that would drive you mad if you thought about it for 2 seconds.
So therefore, what type of person is a comedian? Do you? Is it an inner confidence? Is it a recklessness? What is it?
I think it's a weird mix of a certain inner confidence and a certain neediness, a kind of a desire for the validation. I think there's I don't think it's people discussing who gets into comedy, who doesn't get into comedy. I don't think it's a show of strength getting into comedy a lot of the time. Obviously, it's you get to be the king of the room, but that is appealing to a young man who was shy in his teens who suddenly discovers a way to be the king of the room. That's essentially, I think, the psychosis at the heart of it for a lot of the guys who do it, we're quite dorky and geeky, and then we discover that if we say these words in the right order, we will get the love we were denied as teenagers at the school disco.
I was recently at a wedding between a girl from Cork who's Catholic and a guy from Edinburgh who's Protestant. A mixed marriage. Yes, panto crowd. It will never work. I know exactly what you're thinking. You can't have a mixed marriage. The kids will be freaks. The DNA of Catholic and Protestant aren't supposed to be meshed like that. You'll get some sterile mule child of some description. Mule child, take the bag to the room. What's wrong with the child? Don't talk to the mule child. He is born of Catholic and Protestant. He is wrong. He is an abomination.
Because you studied maths and theoretical physics at university,
yes,
and then
yes,
ended up a stand-up comedian.
Yes, I'm a prototype of that particular thing. I mean, like, I come across hopefully as quite well balanced, but secretly, because you notice that very few, really very few comedians are good looking. I said he's striking.
Paddy Kilties, he's quite good looking.
He's quite good looking, yeah. But we always hated him for that. And Brand, Russell Brand, and maybe Russell Howard, there's a couple of them. But most of us are best in darkness, best at night, best on the radio, best in context where we shouldn't be trading on our look.
You described yourself as one of the Sopranos henchmen, didn't you?
Somebody said that you have that Tony Soprano look about you. And since I've gotten a little bit older and actually now own a barbecue, and I don't barbecue in the dressing gown like he did or whatever. that house girl, yeah. But yeah, we're not born for that. We're born for something else. And also, there is an element, it's a weird kind of game you play in terms of esteem anyway, because you can't, as a stand-up, I mean, rappers can walk around rapping about this and different, their incredibly successful lifestyles. Comedians can't. You know, the minute you say, well, you know, I was recently flying business class, the audience just switch off. And so you have to keep yourself pretty grounded, I think, in this.
How did you get the break across the water? Because that's difficult to do.
There is a path there. There is a route. There are gigs you can do and a circuit you can do. And then there's Edinburgh, of course. So essentially, it was the Edinburgh Festival, and people will come and see your shows. That's the thing. It's a trade fair, but you do actually, if you keep plugging away at it, then hopefully. I mean, it's not pure meritocracy. There's luck involved as well. But people do actually come along and attend these things, and then it becomes a case of getting a chance on something like a panel show, and then showing you did well there and moving on. I mean, again, people are disdainful of panel shows, but like amidst the British desire to have parlour games constantly, that's our doorway in. You know, and we'll work within this kind of the idea that BBC producers like there to be rules and rounds.
Well,
and points.
Even beyond the workings, the mechanics of the show, they like there to be rules. The BBC now. I see Jason Manford in the Radio Times this week calling the BBC's decision to ban all male panels on comedy shows as brilliant.
Yeah, well, no, I've no problem with that as well. I think there were some shows that were being a bit resistant to having female comics on, and there are some great female comics on. And particularly at the moment, we're having there's a whole burst of new comics anyway. Mock the Week has become a slightly different beast, not just because we've had more women on, but because we've had more young
comics.
But
there wouldn't
be
the same uproar, Dara, would there, if there were all female panels on? Is the pendulum not swinging too much?
I think that's in itself sort of slightly. Well, listen, Loose Women, you're running for 10 years.
Precisely,
that's an all-female show, and it's been doing very, very well. But I don't think. Yeah, but that's like saying that's like being people who go, oh, it's International Women's Day when it's International Men's Day. You know, that's rather missing the point. Like I think the numbers of women who go into it are quite low still. So I think the odds are always going to be, well, for the time being anyway, there's going to be predominantly male anyway, just because of the pool that they're drawing from. I got into a weird debate about this because I'm hugely in favour of having as much representation as possible because they know they're very good. They're very funny women on the show. But I got in some tiny scrap with David Dimbleby over this, who's going, well, we have 50% of our panel are women. I'm going, well, it should be because you represent the population. We, unfortunately, don't. We represent people who got into comedy, which is a far weirder, tinier group of people. So it will mean for a while, I think you'll still see. I think if people are worried about this, suddenly it turning very female, I think we're a while away, unfortunately, from that. It's still predominantly a male industry.
You've almost 2 million followers, which puts my 100,000 just, it blows. I'm peewee compared to you, Mr.
Yes,
Dara.
The Twitter thing is interesting because any time that I see one of these kind of Twitter analytics, as they say, where they tell you what's happened and what's not happened and how many people have actually looked at a tweet, you'll never get close to that number. I think the 2 million includes a lot of people who went onto it 2 years ago or 5 years ago and have got bored of it and have left since, but the account never shut.
What's the attraction to you, though? Because you do get into wee arguments with punters and things. And
I get into arguments with people who pick arguments with me.
Yeah.
Because they don't know you.
They don't.
But if people are rude, this is like if you're out and somebody came up to you and was rude to you, you'd set them straight. I mean, that's generally the way I do it.
Do you get much abuse?
You do get a bit. I mean, there's little subcultures of it. Like, there's a kind of a video gaming subculture which got a little bit unpleasant last year. There was a lot of UKIP supporters who got really angry at me over discussion over being an immigrant. A lot of them got really, because I said, well, sure, I'm an immigrant myself, and they're going, you're not really? And you're going, I left home and flew to another country. I'm not sure what your definition is. But they got very stroppy about the whole thing. But, it's funny. What I have done, and what you're absolutely right, I should stop doing, is having arguments with people who won't put their name to it, because there is a weird kind of thing of having an anonymous account, and you're kind of going, if you're not going to put your name to it, then
So do you know what happens with me? Because I get a fair amount of abuse on Twitter.
Yes, you're Stephen. You're a belligerent person. I've heard your show.
Yeah, I annoy a fair few people. Yeah,
yeah.
I noticed you didn't say you liked the show. Did we notice that?
See, we used to. You know, the Five Live at 11 o'clock at night, we've heard lots of the show. Driving around the motorways of England is often where we go to, so I can chime in with opinions on things.
Well, thank you for doing so. What I was going to say is, what I do is, if someone tells me they disagree with whatever, that's fair. I'm fair game on that. But it's interesting. So if someone comes on and they're absolutely absolutely abusive, you know, with vulgarity that's even beyond what I can cope with, right? So I just block them. What's really interesting about that? You see, if you block them, that's what annoys them more than anything, because they think they've got a God-given right to keep on abusing it. There are people that actually have written official complaints to the BBC. Seriously, saying, I know I said this, you know, really, really aggressive, bad language. And yet they feel that right to do so, which is interesting.
I've had people come up to me months later and go, oh, well, you know, you got very choppy with me once. And I go, I imagine I was reacting to something and said, well, I may have disagreed with you about something. You're like, really? Do you want to go back over the tone exactly that you said? Also, there is a funny thing that that Irish, particularly down in the south, have a tendency to say things which are, like, I mentioned the kind of Asher, you're only a, you know, but they'll write that down and taken out of it without the kind of the tone, it's literally just somebody calling you a fat whatever.
Yeah.
And you're going, no, you know that just reads, I'm not seeing you smiling as you say that, I'm just seeing those words. And like they go, oh, right. A lot of the times there's people who I find are incredibly abusive. I hold back a little bit now and I go, are you sure you meant that quite that out of sound? Because honestly, 6% of the time they go, oh, no, I just meant it as a kind of a... And you're going, it doesn't read like that. It reads bluntly and grimly. Oh, it's a strange... I've just finished reading John Ronson's book about public shaming, which I'd recommend heartily, about whether this is a thing now that everyone piles in on, you know, somebody makes a mistake or says an offensive thing and suddenly we all express our opinion and that adds up to this... this tidal wave of opprobrium about things.
And they have to lose their job and they have to be destroyed.
Yes, exactly. And there's a touch of we should watch that because it's very easy. You don't have to leave your house to be part of a mob now. So that's a thing we should all watch out for a bit, I think.
Tell me this. This is a fat man question, me being fat. Do you worry about your weight?
Occasionally, yes. When I do. Look, I know I've got to lose about. I probably lose about 2.5 stone. I don't go on about it. I don't make a thing of it because I dread getting any part of any industry. If I do, in the times when I do lose weight, I would hate to be asked about it, and it'd be like a, you know, well, this is my secret. So I do bursts of exercise and stuff. Yeah, I do need to shift a couple of stone. Yeah,
I lost 7 stone there last year.
Jesus, really?
And I've put 6 of it back on.
I know. Yeah, I lost 3.5, and I've gone up 2.5. That's the general thing. It seems that I have a number which is the number I should be at, and I have a number which I naturally seem to gravitate towards.
Okay, if I can ask the question outright, just spit it out.
Do
you feel any type of pressure to,
no,
you know,
don't.
you're an incredibly successful comedian now. You know, you're mainstream. You're up there at the very top. Therefore, do you feel any pressure to look more the part? That's what I'm trying to ask.
I'm working within an industry which it isn't really that important. And in fact, if anything, as a trope, you know, as a kind of a cliche, the jolly fat man works all right, to be honest. I occasionally find myself watching Stargazing, standing next to Brian Cox and go, oh, he's a very good looking young man, even though he's older than me. Honestly, partly because I went bald so early, you're out of the beauty game quite quickly. And also generally I've also never found that it's held me back in any particular way. It's any pressure that I felt is generally me going, really, this is for my own good and my health.
And Dara, do you feel any pressure being on the big shows now? Does that carry a weight with it, or are you just able to enjoy it?
Honestly, there's nothing been on. I would feel probably more pressure if I was on something that was very mainstreaming, which I didn't feel as a natural fit. And I generally tend to be on BBC Two, or we'll do a live show, for example, on the there's an eclipse in a week and a half, and we're going to do a live broadcast to the country on BBC One, and that will be watched by, I think there's general figures for something like that. Anyone who's watching television at that time of the morning will be watching that.
The battle at the moment with astrologers. Now, I say astrologers in the full knowledge that half the room, myself included, have to do a quick, oh, Jesus, which one is that? Astronomer, astrologer, which one is which, right? Irritating it is that these two things that have such incredibly different philosophies have such ridiculously similar names as astrology and astronomy. Everyone makes this mistake. Karen Brady off The Apprentice, who is ultra-efficient, very professional woman, always very smart, whatever. I met her just before I did the show Stargazing Live, the science show I did with Brian Cox, right? And I met her just before that in the BBC, and she said, oh, what are you doing next? And I said, I'm doing a show about astronomy. And Karen Brady went, ooh, you don't believe in that. Do you? Yes, Karen, I believe in the stars. Everyone makes that mistake. Everyone makes up astronomy and astrology. In fact, I will give you a little hint, a little kind of, you know, a learning aid so that you don't make that. You know, remember Richard of York gave battle in vain to remember the colours of the spectrum? Here's a very simple one to remember which one is astronomy and which one is astrology, right? And it's all in the word. Astronomy, nommy, nom, as in nom, 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 Brian Cox is delicious. Astrology, logy, log, a unit of poo. That's
how. You're a big science buff, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it's actually we're all kind of eager and excited about it. So you don't really think about it. Weirdly, the bigger the television audience doesn't really register because it's in the room. It's actually the one that really scares you, the ones that genuinely scare you, is the very start of the comedy process where you have a sheet of paper of jokes you haven't tried before. And there's 60 people in a room and you can see all their faces. More scary.
Talking about science, you met Stephen Hawking, didn't you?
I did. We did a series of interviews with him for a... It was when Darby meets Stephen Hawking.
What was that like?
Fabulous. Absolutely fantastic. Just a genuine... Because I had a copy of on my shelves of A Brief History of Time that I had been given. I'd requested as a birthday, a Christmas present in 1988, and that I had it had survived 26 years of house moves. So the original copy is still there, and now I have it thumbprinted by himself with the signature of it. And we spent some time together in his office looking over some of his stuff. It was amazing. We looked through his telescope. It was just, you know. People for some reason think that when you do these travel shows that is you being indulged on a holiday. That's not. That's actually their work. But sitting around talking to Stephen Hawking, it was an absolute pleasure.
Are you living the dream? Are there things you still want to...
But it's kind of like, it's not like that I'm not in a hot tub with a load of models. It's such a specific kind of dream, and it's also a 43-year-old man who's very content for the dream not to be the hot tub and the models and, you know, the fast cars.
Because you've been offered Strictly a few times, haven't you?
Yeah, but I do a thing about this in the show, but actually in genuine, I have a rubbish knee. I couldn't do it anyway. I have a shoddy knee that I can't do anything with. So I couldn't do it anyway. I have a slight admiration for Strictly over all those other shows, but I think there's a separate account somewhere that I will funnel money into that I will only check when a phone call comes through in 20 years' time going, will you go in the Big Brother house? And I'll go, let me just go and finally open this envelope and go, no, I won't.
You mentioned you're in your 40s now, so am I, and, you know, I've just found over the last couple of years, I love live telly because you go in, you do it, you go back home again.
There you go. Yeah.
And, you know, life on the road for a comedian, I wouldn't want that. You know, you're away from your wife, your couple of kids. Do you find that difficult?
That is, you know, every time I talk to people who have young kids as well, the two things they always say, the first thing they say is, oh my God, it must be very difficult to be away from the kids. And then there's a beat, as we say, there's a brief pause, and then they lean in and go, must be great to be away for a couple of days. No kidding, of course. After 4 or 5 days, you're eager to get back. But honestly, it works the same way as well.
I'm sure the wife will love that answer.
She is well aware of the answer. But no. It is, of course. And I think, you know, honestly, ask me after I've finished these 3 months, because this is the first solid block of away 5 or 6 days a week for 12 weeks in a row. At that point, I might be going, this is too much to do. But, you fight your way to get to a position where you're playing the rooms you want to play. You're playing the 1,000-seaters or the 2,000-seaters or whatever. And you're kind of going, this is the greatest privilege. And this will go anyway, because that's showbiz. This, with some stage, will, you know, I won't get to play this all the time. I won't get to play my...
Well, now, does that not terrify you when it all drops away again?
Absolutely. And that is the thing that you're kind of going, let's enjoy this as much as I can.
So what would you do if this stopped for you? What would you do?
Sit around the house and I would be a chore to be around. because I get fidgety when I'm not on tour. In the year that I'm in the off year before I go back out on the road again, I'm drumming the table at home. They, I mean, and even all the other stuff, the mocks and the apprentices and all that, they're grand, but they're not the same as doing a two-hour show. As you know, they're not the same as writing the stories for that and then honing them and then knowing that you're planting a seed in the first half that's going to pay off in the second half. All that stuff, self-directing with depending on an interesting member of the audience, all of that stuff. That's the stuff that you live for, to be honest with that. Everything else is just promo.
Continued success,
you're
Mr. Dara.
A pleasure, and to you as well.
Lovely to talk to you. Thank you.